Hello and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and I'm joined this afternoon in the games room upstairs at Mark's Club by Henry Porter, the political columnist and Vanity Fair's UK editor. Speaking to us just a week after the general election, Henry gives us the inside scoop on the struggles of the modern media landscape before telling us why he was compelled to start the Convention, an organisation that holds the debates that Parliament won't. Along the way, he talks to us about the importance of causing trouble, the dying craft of self-editing, and the power of finishing what you've started. So Henry, thanks very much for coming to speak to us today. You've been in journalism for 30 years,
a bit more.
And even in the last few weeks, it seems, the whole landscape of media and journalism seems to have changed. What with the election and Facebook seeming to influence the election more than even the tabloid newspapers, perhaps. And now we've got George Osborne as the editor of a massive newspaper. What's that like from the inside looking out?
I think the most important thing happened last Thursday. Was it for the first time that tabloids didn't matter in the election? Which was the first thing I noticed on Friday morning that they had, when I was watching the election about 4 or 5 o'clock. I realised that tabloids had no impact on Jeremy Corbyn's run at being Prime Minister at all. And the impact had obviously all taken place with Facebook films, presumably Facebook ads, but the films were watched by sometimes over 1.2 million people. That's an amazing, you know, they reached a bigger audience than the Mail was reaching. And that was really important because the Mail doesn't match that online. And there is a sense that the baton has passed from an older generation, my generation, if you like, men in their late 50s and 60s running tabloids in a vicious manner. And that manner is challenged by a lot of people, not least me. I think it's appalling. And it is absolutely gratifying to know since last Friday morning that they actually no longer wield the influence that they once did. And I think the managements of those papers will begin to think about that very, very seriously because they're already losing circulation and advertising revenue quickly because of Brexit. And they will have to adapt very quickly in order to survive. Now, I don't think they've got it in them. And what will happen is that there will be new media establishments forming on the web. They're not there yet,
right?
But the new powers are beginning to form. And that will not include the Daily Mail, the Sun, the Express, and the Daily Telegraph because they're being run by older people who don't really get what's happening.
Yeah. So is there a huge opportunity now for a young person to step into that editorial role and own their own online kind of hub?
Well, I think, you know, obviously individual bloggers had a huge success as they did in the American election. People with individual voices who are just making sense and publishing their stuff either on Facebook or through it are having a dramatic impact on people's understanding of what the issues are in an election. That, I think, is a good thing, except if these guys then become extreme and start telling a story which is not true.
Yeah.
And so there is much less of an agreed account of what is true now, much less than what I used to, what I grew up with when I was a journalist. You have said these facts are true. There's no alternative because they're just facts and that's the general account of things. It may not have included every aspect, but it certainly did provide people with a consensus of what the truth was about. That's no longer the case. And, you know, the Daily Mail and the Express and the Sun, have tried to own a certain account of Britain. Whether you're Conservative, Liberal, Dem or Labour, that no longer figures if you're under 35. It doesn't figure if you're me, because I always hated them. But it doesn't figure if you're under 35.
No.
Because who buys a newspaper these days?
Yeah.
You know, I buy the FT because it's a really good newspaper. I didn't buy the rubbish, the rest of it. And I don't think a younger generation even entertained the idea of buying their news.
Yeah. And you're an editor at Vanity Fair.
I'm the UK editor.
The UK editor of Vanity Fair. The the magazine cycle and the pace that magazines are run at is obviously different to the daily news cycle. But is there a way that print magazines have also been threatened or shut out of this kind of conversation?
I think they're certainly challenged by it. I wouldn't say they're ended, because a magazine can be a beautiful object in itself to hold in your hand and go to bed with. It's just sometimes nice to hold a magazine. I read lots of magazines, from science magazines to nature magazines. So I'm keen on magazines. But I think where it's been challenged is long-form journalism is also on the web. And, the intensely investigated piece is there for you to read on the web if you've got time.
Yeah.
Or in podcasts like this. People get a lot of their understanding of current events, particularly in America through podcasts, and now with your operation, no doubt, here.
Yeah.
So where you spend your attention is kind of widely diffused compared to what it was, diverse compared to what it was, even 15 years ago. But certainly when I was a journalist your age, there was no such palette of opportunities. There was no real choice. And the choice is good.
Yeah.
It just means, as I say, the kind of singular account of things have changed.
Yeah. If there's more choice out there for young journalists, just before we started recording, you were telling me that you don't think anyone really pays for real journalism anymore. Do you think it's now easier to be a journalist starting out, or do you think it's now tougher than it was, say, 30 years ago?
I think it's easier to get your stuff printed.
Right.
It's less easy to make a living out of it.
Wow.
I think it's palpably it's less easy because so much is given away free by people.
Yeah.
Like these blogs I mentioned. So palpably it's less easy to make money. But I certainly think, the young journalists I know, they are getting stuff published.
Yeah.
I think perhaps where that is a slight problem is people getting published without ever being edited properly.
Okay.
Without ever being, I can think of a young journalist I know who, just uses too many adverbs, and somebody needs to tell her that.
Right.
And or just show how much clearer her copy would be without all these metaphors and similes and adverbs cluttering up the understanding if she just said, dog walked down the street.
Yeah.
So editing is there's a dearth of good editing.
Mm.
And that applies to books as well.
Really?
Editing I write novels and I have a brilliant editor who's a bit older than me.
Yeah.
And she really goes through a book with like a knit comb, She picks out all those tiny awkwardnesses. And that used to be the case in American journalism, where you had really intensive with the magazine I work for, Vanity Fair, still has very good editing. But you sense that this is a quality that is going to pass, like the sort of craftsmanship you used to see in old Rolls Royces or something like that.
Right,
that
okay.
is going to pass.
Yeah. So if you were now 23, 21, do you think you'd go on the same career path as a writer, as a journalist?
It's damn difficult to get published as a novelist, And I've written quite a few novels. I think I was really lucky in the sense that I worked for very established newspapers in their prime. So I worked for the Evening Standard, then the Sunday Times, and then the Observer and the Sunday Telegraph, all of whom had money, in the 80s and 90s. And so I think it is much, much harder for younger journalists. And the career path is not nearly so clear where you go. Which direction do you aim? It's really hard. And everyone's expecting you to be so adaptable and agile these days, which I think is kind of stressful for people.
What do you mean, writing about different subjects, having different
specialisms? Well, moving careers and jumping from one thing to the other. And it's just considered a virtue. Well, it's not always a virtue. Sometimes it's a virtue to stay doing the same thing and getting better and better at it. I mean, I've written political columns for about four different newspapers over about 25 years. And I got better at it for the reason that I just did it over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And eventually you end up with perhaps less to say than you used to have, and at which point I quit or did something else. But, practice and staying in the same thing is not a bad, boring thing to do.
No.
If you become a painter, stay painting.
Okay.
Become a tennis player, stay playing tennis. So I think this idea that everyone should have a dozen different career changes, or at least three or four,
yeah,
is unsettling to people.
Certainly.
Unsettling to their creative, you know, if you want to go from journalism to novel writing or to screenplays, it's unsettling to have this endless challenge of finding new ways of reinventing yourself and then boasting about it on Facebook or Instagram. I think it's a kind of much more punishing world than I used to be in, than I grew up in.
Is it useful, do you think, if you are hopping about, that the talents you learn in a new discipline can then influence the old one? If you do go to screenplay writing, can that help the dialogue in your novel and then help the zappiness of your news articles?
I think they all sort of help each other in a way, if you're a journalist, you know how to research something for a screenplay.
Sure.
If you've written a novel, you probably have a bit of an idea of dialogue, but dialogue in a novel and a screenplay is very different, and much, much more reduced in a screenplay. I think they all feed into each other.
Yeah. You mentioned the Evening Standard a moment ago, at its peak. Do you think it's at its peak now? We've got a new editor in George Osborne, who's never had an editorial role in his life.
Yeah, I think he's a disservice to journalism.
Right.
Because he's far too part of the banking political combine. And I don't believe he would... I think this is slightly unfair, because he's only been in the job for 6 weeks, 7 weeks. But I don't really think... I see him... You know, having a go at May or Corbyn, whoever it is, these are the actions of a politician, not of a journalist. He's somebody who's still engaged in the political game, not the journalist game, which is different. And I would imagine, I don't really see a kind of broader journalistic skill there.
No.
He's just having a go. He's a propagandist.
And do you have friends at the Standard who have expressed... You probably won't mention my name, but who have expressed any discontent?
No, I don't know anyone at the Standard. I used to know the former editor, Sarah Sands, but I don't think she would tell me anything. I think it's...
It seems unfair, doesn't it? That if someone's worked their way all the way up the ladder, they've just been pipped to the post by someone who admittedly might have good access, but has got no real craft or experience. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I do think it's true, but, you know, life is really unfair when you get to the top, particularly in journalism. You know, journalism's rough. Especially in tabloids, it's a rough, it's a rough old game. but I don't know. I don't like the fact that Osborne is using this as a political sounding board.
Yeah,
I don't like that. I think he should have far more respect. So I think he's doing journalism a disservice. Mm. People were worried about him, being a politician as well as a journalist. At the time he accepted the job, he was still an MP, and that he was doing a disservice towards politics. That was not my concern at all, because I have a greater respect for journalism than I do politics.
Right. Have you ever been tempted, having written political columns all your life, to surely you look at all these people and you think, well, I could do a lot better than that, especially the showing in the latest election. Have you ever been tempted to run for office?
No, because I know myself better than that. I think I've just done a big project with the convention on Brexit and political crash. And one of the things I remembered after starting it was the amazing frustration and difficulty of being rejected the whole time by speakers or funders or whoever it is. And that rejection, you have to build a really tough skin. And I think as a politician, you have to build a really super tough skin of being rejected and regarded as the lowest of the low the whole time. I watch people who I sort of know, like Caroline Lucas or Lisa Nandy from the Labour Party, or even David Davis, who I knew pretty well because we campaigned on the same subject for years together on the same platform. They are really tough. Like, they just roll with the punches. They just get up in the morning and go for it again. Yeah. And I wouldn't want to do that.
So you mentioned the convention there. This is a new product you've set up that's kind of a debate and discussion stage on big issues like Brexit. Why did you decide to launch that?
Well, it first of all started in 2009 when I had the idea of convening, as it were, a very large number of speakers in one room to address what I regarded and several other people regarded as a real big attack on civil liberties.
Right.
In 2004, 2005, 2006, and 2007 by Tony Blair's government.
And it really had an impact. It was really good. It focused attention. It put all the main characters, the Attorney General, former head of the Law Lords, MPs like David Davis, all put them all in one room. And that really made everyone concentrate on this attack on liberty. And eventually it came out, coalition agreement in 2010, with the Lib Dems putting a lot of our suggestions into the agreement. So the idea this time was to put together a really serious debate, now this is before the election, about Brexit. Because I think Brexit is a complete and utter disaster. And I think we've got to find a way of going back on this decision and working out how to give people better information on it. It is a utter disaster. One of the things I do is run a website called Brexit Record. And that simply aggregates economic news every morning of tiny little economic bits of economic news, which you wouldn't pick, we pick up from the trade press. Not the Daily Mail, Sun or the Express, trade press, small local newspapers, sometimes the FT, Reuters and Bloomberg. And we aggregate that, and it is a disaster. So that's what I wanted to do, was to put 100 speakers together, which we did have. We had 2 days of debate. It cost nearly £250,000.
Wow. 100 speakers in 2 days?
Yep. They're on panels and stuff. Yeah. So we had Bob Geldof and Ian McEwan and really well-known thinkers as well as speakers, psychologists who talked about psychology to defeat, people who talked about the use of big data in elections.
And this was after the vote, after the referendum?
No, it's between. It was after the referendum. It was mid-April.
Yeah.
Mid-May. It was just, we were sort of tripped up by Theresa May, who called the election just after Easter, and that was halfway, just 3 weeks before we were launching. That was a really big thing. Large numbers of tickets sold. And it was, I have to say it myself, complete success. Mm-hmm. I had sleepless nights for 3 months, but it really worked. And the point why it worked was people were sick of the lack of the debate.
Yeah.
There was no debate after the referendum about Brexit in Parliament because the Labour Party had agreed with the Tories that we're going to have a hard Brexit. And the election campaign had started, and Theresa May was wandering around empty factory spaces saying absolutely nothing about her plans. She said, I have a plan, but she wouldn't tell anyone. Even though she called the Brexit election to talk about Brexit, she wouldn't tell us about her plan. Still hasn't. So I was really sick of the debate and lack of debate. And what we did was had two good days of debate. Now, what's the point of that? Well, I think the point is to keep that kind of intellectual energy alive in the capital. It's like really serious stuff. And we didn't compromise on any of the standards. Mm-hmm. We said, this has got to be the debate. I wrote out the terms. I and another guy called Guy Aitchison wrote out the terms of each debate, really thought through the issues, gave the speakers and the chairs a kind of guide of what we wanted each debate to be, whether it was a crash of politics, the economy under Brexit, the NHS under. We defined the debate before. We did a lot of thinking before. And that's really important. You don't just shove people on stage and say, talk about this subject for 40 minutes and you'll have a Q&A at the end. We did the thinking. And that thinking, I think, is really important. And I think we'll continue with it.
Yeah.
And we'll go highbrow rather than lowbrow and make films of it and as you do, podcasts.
And how do you measure the success of that? How can you, I mean, it was only a few weeks ago, but how can you see if that's had an impact at all?
It had a good impact on the web. So it was good sort of uptake on Twitter and Facebook.
But does it change any political policy? Does it change?
No, I don't think it, I mean, I think political policy, I think it might change the thinking sometimes at the top. You can just aim an arrow. You can, but it's really difficult. This is like these are a lot of middle-aged people who've got very, very fixed ideas.
Yeah.
I have very fixed ideas about Brexit being appalling, but in other respects, I think I'm very flexible. And I think the problem with politicians is that they are part of a party and they just have got this bloody rule book of what they're going to say and not. And I think politics become very dead.
Yeah.
So our aim is to put those ideas, not my ideas, but other people's ideas in the currency and say, actually, wouldn't it be a great idea to have a written constitution? Wouldn't it be a great idea to have proportional representation so each vote counts? Yeah. Wouldn't it be a great idea to find a different way of funding students or funding housing or whatever it might be? So to really think. So it's not entertainment. It's really a lot of thinking.
Yeah.
And I like that. And I find it stimulating and it's great to put together.
We're in kind of these very dramatic times, and there's that old expression, which I'm not sure is true, that the Chinese word for crisis has danger and opportunity in it. Do you think that this is now an amazing opportunity for people, whether in business, in politics, in journalism, in fact, or do you think it's all doom and gloom?
No, I don't think it's doom and gloom, but I do think it requires engagement, and your generation is providing that engagement. So I have no worries about that. And I think your generation, if I can be so, you know, I'm not being patronizing, I'm just saying that I think your generation in the last year has really understood that enormous catastrophes can happen if they don't vote or they vote the wrong way. And I think that's been really important, and that penny has properly dropped in a way that it never dropped with my generation. Yeah. We were sort of protesting, you know, about Vietnam War, and then the fall of the Berlin Wall came along in 89 and stuff. So things seem to be getting endlessly better for my generation. They weren't, of course, because we were screwing up the climate, screwing up the housing stock, and doing lots of things that we didn't pay attention to. But I think your generation is properly engaged, and I think that's a really good thing. And I think it will produce a fundamentally fresher and different kind of politics. As long as that's democratic and liberal, I have no issues.
Yeah. And just to speak about the craft of writing, it was very interesting how you were saying about editing. Do you think now young people don't self-edit enough? Even in every day of their lives, they're kind of publishing and broadcasting everything they do. Do you think people should take more chance to listen to either people above them editing them or...
Well, I think self-criticism's good.
Yeah.
I'd not say that it cripples you. But, I mean, reading George Orwell, I got collected letters of George Orwell. Mm. Now, this is a guy who died, I think, in 48. So he died before I was born. And it was slightly later. But because he wrote 1984 and 48, because he reversed the 4 and the 8. And if you read him, you realize how crisp and intelligent he is. And the sense of just being very clear the whole time. Hmm. You know, he said that prose should be a pane of glass that you look through. You know, that it shouldn't get in the way. It shouldn't be too ornate, so it's getting in the way. And I think that's really true, and people should really strive for that clarity. And some bloggers have really got it. They really, you know, they can really write clearly. And that's really is the first thing.
Yeah.
So I think that requires quite a lot of self-editing. I mean, I'm writing a piece today, you know, and I've gone over the middle 5 paragraphs over and over because it's, you know, it's bollocks to begin with, and we're sort of getting there, you know.
So you're a very experienced writer. Maybe to any budding journalists out there who are listening, how long does it take you to write an 800-word piece, and how many drafts to go through, and how many hours sleep do you lose over it?
Well, it depends. If it's a political piece for the Observer, which I used to write every Friday, it would take me the best part of 12 hours, so it's 1,100 words, and then I'd rewrite very early Saturday morning if I'd kind of gone off on a tangent, or I'd sort of been phony or too much what everyone calls throat clearing at the beginning, when you're not going straight to the heart of the matter. You know, go straight to the heart of the matter, you know, don't sort of waffle.
Yeah.
And everyone's guilty of waffling and getting, so it take me a lot, you know, day and a quarter to really get it sorted in my head. And the day before that I'd be researching, so it's quite a long process.
Yeah.
And if you're writing something, I used to write an awful lot about liberty and stuff. So I'd read all the law. But even though I knew what terror laws said and stuff, I would kind of really think through what was going on in the heads of the politicians who were imposing those laws on us and what their sort of lack of scrutiny was. So I'd spend a lot of time thinking about it. And it should take that long.
Yeah.
It really should take that long. I mean, probably a columnist who's writing for a daily newspaper will write it much quicker. And there are some really good columnists who write over, you know, 4 or 5 hours. Johnny Friedland and The Guardian, for instance, really good, thoughtful columnists, write it pretty quickly. I can write stuff quickly. It's just, I think it's better if you take a time.
Sure. When you're mentoring young writers, is there one mistake you see them make more than often? Or what's the one piece of advice you keep hammering home if you're ever speaking to people reaching out to you for advice?
Well, this is stuff I'm going on about. Be clear, you know. Like when I was a reporter, I started in Liverpool as a reporter in kind of the 70s, and It seems such a long time ago. But it's interesting, the news editor, who's completely detestable bloke with cold sores all over his face and a really bad odour problem, did say, he said, if you want to know how to start a news story, and it's quite good for everything else, actually, you must, think about shouting your message across a busy street to a friend on the other side. What would you say? And those words, you know, will be what we used to call your intro. Those words, 4 or 5, you know, keywords. Yeah. And it was good advice. It does actually work though.
What's it like working for, or having had such a long relationship with a magazine like Vanity Fair that's probably seen as a kind of benchmark of decent magazine journalism? Is it a very, even for you, a tough process to pitch ideas and articles to them?
Yeah, it's really, I never get in. No, I mean, I do get in. I mean, for, you know, I wrote a big piece about the Paris attacks and migration and so forth. But I don't pitch an idea unless I really think it's going to stand a chance of getting in. And I kind of covered the Arab Spring for the magazine. Mm. So I would never say, ooh, I've got an idea about this or that, without it having a serious hope of getting in. As to working for the magazine, it's kind of interesting. All of us have worked together for 25 years. Yeah. So the editor, the entire team has not changed. The designer's changed, but the picture editor's the same, the managing editor's the same, all the copy editors is all the same. So we've all grown old together, but that really does mean that everyone is very good at that job and they're really proficient. And, you know, it's just, when I put on the convention, I put it on with the spirit of what I'd seen Vanity Fair do with the tech summit on the West Coast. It's like really slick, like people were mic'd up properly. So Vanity Fair is not just about journalism, it's about doing stuff really well and crisply. And you know, so I put on the convention we had, you know, as I say, 100 speakers. And I'd seen the same thing done on the West Coast in San Francisco last year and the year before. And I attended both and was part of last year's.
Yeah.
And the slickness was just on. They were on it the whole time. It's the same with journalism. It's really, really good. The editing, the copy editing, the fact checking, the picture research, the checking of captions, all that is just brilliant.
And how much involvement do you have with Graydon Carter, the editor?
He's a really old pal of mine. We worked together. I've known him since he did Spy in the early 80s. Yeah. And then I worked for him occasionally, and he worked for me. We gave each other columns when we had no money.
Yeah.
In the 80s, I had a magazine here, and he had one that he worked for, New York Observer. Owned, I think, by Jared Kushner. Not a proprietor. I had slightly less favour than even Murdoch, actually.
But what's his process like? He's famously quite exacting in his editorial process and knows exactly what he likes and goes on instinct
really
a lot.
He's a really good journalist.
Yeah.
And why he's so good, and he's a pal, but I'd say there's probably less likely to say it because he's a pal and he spends his entire life teasing everybody. But he's really good at a lot of different things. He's really good at design. He's a really good writer himself. And he knows how to tell a story.
Yeah.
He's funny. And he's got this terrific sense of the pace of a magazine. So the variation doesn't get it always right, but he gets the sort of composition of the magazine and the mix. He's really good at that.
Yeah.
So he's a pretty amazing editor, I think. And he's a really fabulous writer. He's really funny.
Do you speak about the people you've met and the people you've worked with. Do you think it's more important who you know than what you know?
I think who you know is pretty important, actually. I'd never kind of be reverse snob about that. Say, oh, it doesn't matter, talent will out. I don't think that's true at all. I think I've been extraordinarily lucky to know the people I've known. I met a lot of good, you know, and really good pals with lots of different editors. And when I was editing magazines and stuff, it was just, you know, it was really useful to know lots of writers. So I've been lucky like that. Yeah. And I think it really does matter. And it really counts in your life.
How do you go about then doing that? How do you
get greasing up to people? Yeah. No, I don't think, I mean, I just think I've always thought that in journalism, it's better to be brave than cautious.
Okay.
And that may lead you into sort of all sorts of trouble, which it has with me, but it's somehow more interesting.
Mm.
And I think people take more interest in you when you're younger if you're causing trouble than towing the line.
Right.
And I think towing the line is not a course to be recommended.
Okay.
I really do think that. And I think put yourself about a bit and bother to have opinions. But having opinions is not easy.
No.
You've got to think about stuff. Whether you know, everyone's got an opinion on Brexit, obviously. But have an opinion on, I don't know, architecture in London, or you know, just to have a thoughtful opinion. Mm. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And people have to work on that. Opinions aren't easy to have.
So is charm more important than talent, do you think?
No, I don't think that. I think talent, I mean, I think charm is, I think charm is important, but I think I don't have huge amounts of charm. I do have a lot of energy.
Right.
So energy is as important as talent.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of people who are really clever, but kind of can't be fished, or can't, you know, don't really see the point of making the effort.
Yeah.
I think energy will beat them all the time.
And do you have a personal motto in your working life, in your personal life?
Yeah, finish it. Get it done.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, just always finish everything you do and finish strongly. You know, I really, you know, it was really scary setting up this convention, but we completed it and I think it was a 100% success. I have no embarrassment in saying that.
Hmm.
Finish a novel, I finished a novel, finished the piece I'm writing. To, you know, just make sure you finish stuff.
Mm.
Not kind of think, oh, well, I'll come back to the novel after the summer. You know, finish it.
Wonderful. Well, on that note, we'll finish the podcast there. Mm. Henry Porter, thank you very, very much for coming to speak to us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal, or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you very, very soon.